6. Foxy had a face that was well lived in for 50, or in good shape for 70, and since she never told anyone her age, I couldn't say which it was. She was 6 feet tall and wore black leather boots with heels. She had on a denim skirt, a hot pink top, 3 necklaces, and a bright orange scarf. Her earrings would have reached her shoulders, but they kept getting tangled up in her scarf, and then she'd free them with a practiced flick. Her fingernails were a brilliant turquoise. On 99% of humanity, the outfit would have been a riot of mismatched color. On Foxy, it somehow all pulled together. She looked like a cross between a drag queen and a wildflower meadow. After we sorted out the issue of whether or not I was being murdered, Bongo had to be soothed with petting and dog treats, and I had to put on something more substantial than a towel. Foxy leaned against the kitchen counter and looked around. "Forgive the mess," I said hopelessly. "Ain't your mess, hon," said Foxy. "We all know what the old lady was like. Tomas said you're here to clean the house out, and I wouldn't wish that job on anybody."
"Tell me about it."
"Came over to thank you for the microwave."
She moved restlessly, setting her jewelry clicking together.
"And shit, you ain't eating ramen for dinner, are you?"
I shuffled hurriedly in front of the ramen on the counter.
"Come have dinner with us tonight," she said. It was somewhere between an offer and an imperial command. "It's just me and Tomas and Skip, but we'll do you up a damn sight better than ramen."
I was torn between a strong desire for a real meal and human company, particularly after that weird afternoon in the stones, and an equally strong desire to stay home, read the rest of Cotgrave's diary, and maybe get to the bottom of things.
"Well, your mama alive?" asked Foxy abruptly.
No.
"Then if she's looking down from heaven, she'll want to make sure somebody was feeding you, not eating ramen in this nasty old rat trap."
I bowed to a will superior to my own. "May I have an hour?" I asked humbly. "I'm still damp." Foxy grinned.
"Look at me, rushing in here and dragging you out to eat dinner with soap still in your hair. Come on over when you're ready, hon. Just cross the road and up to the big house."
And with that, she swept out, leaving me slightly dazed in her wake. I could hear her immense boots clack on the steps as she went out. I couldn't imagine wearing heels that size on a gravel driveway, but she didn't seem to notice.
"I guess I'm going out to dinner," I told Bongo.
But first, there was something important to do. I put a towel around my shoulders to catch drips and sat on the bed with Cotgrave's diary in hand.
If I was hoping for a great revelation, "By the way, I've taken up sculpting," I didn't get it.
There were several pages about the adjustments to his medication and a few repetitions of the litany of the twisted ones. It gave me the creeps reading it, now that I'd seen what it probably referred to. "I made faces like the faces on the rocks." "You did not," I muttered. "Human faces don't work that way." I deliberately did not think about what had happened on the hill. It was just me being stupid. Then, about halfway through the book,
"Slept in woods again. Had to. Saw one of their puppets. Just watched. Didn't do anything. Don't know if they can hurt someone or just scare them. With my heart, not much difference."
He'd underlined difference. The rest of the page was blank, except for another drawing of Kilroy, sideways this time. Another few pages of nothing much. I squeezed water out of my hair. Then,
"Met girl in woods. Near place of stones."
I sat up straighter.
"Hello," I muttered. Had Cotgrave been having an affair? No, he was old with a bad heart, although that doesn't always stop people.
She knows. One of them? Doesn't seem like it. Not normal, though. Beautiful hair. Ambrose believed in changelings. No reason to think he was wrong. Younger than the ones I saw in Wales, anyway, if one of them.
Cotgrave had seen changelings in Wales? Well, I'd never been, but it seemed like the sort of place you'd get them. Perhaps Welsh fairies stole children and confiscated their vowels.
I've almost finished typing up manuscript. Remember more than I thought I did, but know I'm forgetting parts. Hit it. Won't say where. Think she might be reading this. If you are, then you're an awful old biddy, and I wish I'd died before I married you. Go ahead and say something about that, if you're willing to admit you've been snooping.
Ha! I punched the air. Poor old Cotgrave. But he'd gotten in a blow there. Grandma would never admit to wrongdoing. If she yelled at him for calling her names, she'd be in the wrong for reading his private papers. It must have driven her up the wall not being able to call him on it. I sighed, and she'd probably taken it out on the old man, too. But it's not like she would have been sweetness and light otherwise, anyway.
Won't say any more here. Doesn't matter anyway. Gonna get out one way or the other. And you'll finally be free of me, you old bat.
He'd underlined "you old bat" twice, and that was it, the last entry. The rest of the book was blank. I flipped through it, carefully at first, then increasingly annoyed. Damn it, Cotgrave, you couldn't have said something. A helpful clue for the person reading your journal. By the way, the girl I met lived down the road, and here's her phone number if you'd like to ask her about the stones. Gah! Well, presumably there was more in his typed manuscript, which quite possibly my grandmother had found and disposed of. No, she wouldn't have disposed of it. She hadn't disposed of the diary, and it insulted her to her face. She couldn't throw away anything. It was in the house somewhere, surely, with the green book and 1,000 old penny savers and the corks to every bottle of wine she'd ever opened. I sighed and shoved the journal into the desk drawer, then ran the towel over my drying hair. It was time to dress for dinner. Foxy was sitting out on the front porch. She had a mason jar in her hand, full of ice and amber, which she waved in my direction.
"It's a mint julep," she said. "Want one?"
"I don't see any mint," I said.
"Yeah, we ran out."
"Doesn't that make it just a julep?"
"No," said a gray-haired man, stepping out onto the porch behind her. "Because she doesn't put any simple syrup in it either."
Foxy grinned.
"Oh, but mint juleps are so classy. Just straight bourbon over ice makes it sound like I'm a lush."
"I'll take one," I said. After my experience with the carved stones, getting blitzed seemed like a delightful idea. The house was a sagging ramshackle affair with a battered tin roof. There were a couple extra additions and a covered carport that held cobwebs and elderly machinery. I could see a single wide trailer set at right angles to it and another farther back on the property. A radio played tinnily from inside the house. We sat on the front porch drinking un-juleps and watching fireflies blink on and off over the grass. The gray-haired man was named Skip. He had a thick braid down his back and pretty much screamed aging hippie. He was a potter.
"Not that it's hard to be a potter around here," he said. "The clay's alive. Red clay, like blood. It wants to be useful. Practically throws itself."
I nodded politely into my unjulep.
Foxy rolled her eyes behind his back. Tomas came up with grease on his hands and launched into a diatribe about tractor engines that I didn't even begin to understand.
"Cool, cool," said Foxy. "Dinner's nearly ready, hon."
"It needs a new glorchometer and a zepulator cap," he said.
Okay, not really, but hell if I can remember what he actually said.
"That glashometer's been fixing to go for ages," said Foxy.
"Well, it's gone now. We'll have to get a new one."
"I'll just thump it a few times. It'll be fine."
Tomas sighed, gave me a "see what I have to put up with" look, and went to scrub off his hands. We all tromped inside. It was dark in the house, with battered 70s wood paneling, but there were shockingly day-glow rock posters on most of the walls. Bob Marley smiled down benignly over the dinner table, holding a joint between his fingers. Skip pulled a casserole out of the oven, baked in a broad pottery dish. Foxy refilled my unjulep to the top.
"Did you make the dishes?"
I asked, as Skip slapped out generous spoonfuls into bowls.
"He did indeed," said Foxy proudly. "He sells them for a small fortune at a gallery in town, but we get to eat off them every day."
Skip ducked his head, looking embarrassed. The casserole was a fine example of what can be done with cans of cream of mushroom soup. It still beat ramen. We ate in silence, except for the radio and the sounds of silverware clinking against stoneware. Foxy put a scoop into a bowl and set it on the floor for Bongo, who slurped it up with great enthusiasm. I must take steps to ensure that my vet never reads this. Tomas had seconds and then gathered up the bowls.
"You doing okay over there?"
he asked.
"Nothing bothering you?"
"All kinds of things are bothering me," I said,
compelled to honesty by the alcohol.
"I was up the bald hill behind the house."
They looked at me. I waited for someone to say,
"Oh yeah, that was just Moonshine Hill."
"A hill?" said Skip. "No real hills around here."
Tomas came to my defense, probably out of chivalry.
"There's some rises back there. If you're walking, it sure seems like you're climbing."
This was what I'd feared, but I plowed ahead anyway.
"No, it was a real hill. You know, the one covered with all the carved stones?"
The table went suddenly silent, except for the blare of the radio. It was playing Lydia, the Tattooed Lady. If you are ever planning on having a serious conversation with people you barely know about weird carvings on an impossible hill behind your house, try to get a better soundtrack. Foxy looked at me solemnly across the table.
"You seen those stones?" she said.
I said, "Yeah. I mean, there's a hill and a whole bunch of them on top."
"That's not a good place, man," said Tomas. "My grandma, she'd say there were devils up there."
"Huh," said Foxy. "Don't know about devils."
I noted that we had somehow skipped completely over the question of whether the hill existed. This did not make me feel better. The radio informed us that we could learn a lot from Lydia.
"There were just carvings," I said, even though they hadn't been just carvings.
But if I admitted they were more than that, I'd be opening a door to a whole lot of things. I wanted that door to stay firmly closed.
"Mostly," said Foxy. "Mostly they are. Sometimes they ain't, like the hill. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it ain't."
"Who made them?" I asked, shoving the question of disappearing hills behind that mental door with the rest. Lydia, we were told, could show you the world on various parts of her anatomy. Foxy turned her head and said,
"Shut that damn thing off, will you?"
Skip leaned back in his chair and flipped off the radio.
I was more relieved than I could say.
"Don't know," said Foxy. "Not sure anybody made them."
"Somebody had to make them," I said.
"Maybe they grew," said Foxy. "Ever think of that, eh?"
She slammed back the rest of her unjulep. This was a very unpleasant thought.
"Couldn't it have been, I don't know, Indians or something?"
Foxy snorted.
"There were people here for 1,000 years before white men landed," she said. "But I doubt any of them were ever fool enough to make things like that."
She glanced at Skip.
"Don't look at me," he said. "My people were all Chamawa, whole other side of the continent, like sensible folk. If you want a wise old Indian to dispense sacred wisdom, go find somebody from around here. Me? I throw pots."
"I'd stay away from them," said Tomas, who had been listening silently the whole time. "You leave stuff like that alone, it leaves you alone. Mostly."
I wondered what counted as leaving stuff alone. Not wandering around in fields, singing to myself? Not making faces at the rocks? No, that was just nerves. Nothing really happened. You're suggestible because the whole thing was freaky, that's all. I licked my lips. They stung a little from the bourbon.
"Did any of you know Cotgrave, my step-grandfather?"
"Before my time," said Tomas. "I did," said Skip, surprising me. "Decent old man. Used to ramble around the woods a bit. Rambled a bit in his head, too, I think."
He sighed.
"Felt bad for him, being married to, well, I shouldn't say, on account of her being your grandmother."
"Don't worry about it," I said, taking a hard swig and nearly choking. Foxy pounded me enthusiastically on the back. I know what she was like. It's fine.
"Cotgrave wasn't bad," said Skip. "Mostly, I think he just wasn't there most of the time."
He tapped his forehead.
"Probably the best way to get through being married to my grandmother," I said. Did he ever say anything about a man named Ambrose? Or,
I wanted to say, the Twisted Ones, but I couldn't. Not that something was stopping me, but the phrase sounded suddenly stupid in my head, like a cheap slasher film.
"Ooh, the Twisted Ones. Scary."
All we needed was a bleached blonde co-ed to scream convincingly.
Skip thought for a moment. "Ambrose. Sorry, no. He might have, but it was so long ago now, and I didn't know him well. He would just come by the studio sometimes on his walks, helped me with a kiln opening a time or two."
"Ah, well," I said, "worth a try."
"Don't go spooking yourself," Foxy suggested. "You're already in that house with all that crap. No sense making it worse."
"Thanks," I said dryly. "I've been trying to forget." She grinned and topped up my bourbon.
"Here, this'll help."
It is extremely difficult to find a book in a hoarder's house. No, let me qualify that. It is extremely difficult to find a specific book. I spent most of the next day yanking drawers open, searching for the green book, or Cotgrave's manuscript, I wasn't picky, tearing through boxes, even looking under the couch cushions. I accomplished nothing, except to trash the newly cleaned living room, and eventually gave up in defeat and admitted that this was not the way to find anything.
"Systematic," I told Bongo gloomily. "I have to be systematic. She could have put it anywhere."
Bongo opened one eye, decided that this did not sound like food, and closed it again. "Anywhere. Upstairs, or on the blocked-up porch, or even in a garbage bag I'd thrown out before I knew what I was looking for."
"Crammed under a dead baby doll," or in the box of something as seen on TV. And she was trying to hide it, which made it 10 times worse. Cotgrave's typed manuscript should be easier, shouldn't it? In theory, he wasn't a hoarder. Assuming she didn't throw it out after he died. I straightened up the living room, feeling discouraged, took Bongo out, and went to bed. I dreamed that night about the white stone. People in books always have such wonderfully clear dreams that show you their secret fears or reveal some key element of their tormented past or whatever. But in reality, if you try to explain a dream, you end up saying, I was talking to Abraham Lincoln, but he was also sort of my father, and we were in the house I grew up in, but the window screen kept falling out, and I was trying to wedge it back in over and over again, and I was getting really frustrated, and also I wasn't wearing pants. Well, in my dream, I was talking to Cotgrave, who was also sort of my father, and I was looking for someone, except that I kept digging through the boxes in the doll room trying to find them. We were in my first apartment, but the doll room was in it. I was getting very annoyed because Cotgrave wouldn't help me find whoever I was looking for. Then the dream changed, and I went into another room. The living room of my first apartment, with the popcorn ceiling and the bong water-colored carpet, and the white stone was standing in the middle of the room. I was enormously relieved because that's who I had been looking for all along. In the dream, I saw the carvings and understood what they were supposed to be. I went up to the stone and pressed myself against it, wrapping my legs around it, trying to touch the stone as much as I could, cheek and breast and belly and thigh, and the stone was cold, and no matter how closely I held it, I couldn't warm it at all. Then something woke me up, and I rolled over and discovered I'd kicked most of the blankets over Bongo. He was snoring. I hauled the blankets back over myself and went back to sleep, and the dreams after that were all the usual foolishness about not being able to remember what period I had math class in. Maybe if I'd had a terrifying nightmare about the stone, things might have gone differently, and I wouldn't have stayed. Maybe I would have thrown on my clothes, told my father to have the house demolished, and driven away. But I don't know. I think by then, probably, I was already in too far. I woke one more time that night when Bongo launched himself off the bed at the window, baying like a lunatic.
Gah! Ugh! What?
He smacked his nose against the window, rebounded, and the bay turned into a yelp, then back to a bay again. Bongo, as I believe I've mentioned, is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. It was deer again. Skip had said they were everywhere out here, and here was proof. Long-legged shapes bounded across the driveway into the trees. Damn it, dog! You're a coonhound, not a deerhound. Bongo scrabbled at the window, indicating his willingness to branch out. I put my chin on top of his skull and looked out the window. His ears were pricked up as far as they could go, not very far given the floppiness, and made 2 soft bumps on either side of my jaw. 2 more deer went by, and then the last of them. There was something wrong with this one's front legs. It was not exactly limping, but it held itself wrong. For a moment, I thought I was looking at a person running stooped over, with their arms dangling in front. I jerked back, startled. The deer crossed the moonlit gravel drive. No, it was only a deer. It had the long neck and the tapered head. There was just something wrong with its front legs, or perhaps its back, that made it shuffle along. It vanished into the trees. Bongo said, "Roo, woo, woof," and dropped down, sulking that I wouldn't let him eat the deer. I sighed. I felt bad for the deer, whatever was wrong with it. I suppose I could call a wildlife rehabber or something, tell them there was an injured deer in the woods, for all the good that would do. It's not like I had it in my truck, ready to deliver. Anyway, if a deer was an adult and walking, I'd read that it was more stressful to be captured and treated than just to wander around with a broken leg. Assuming it was a leg, it had actually looked more like a back problem. Were there hunchbacked deer? Well, there was that dolphin at the one zoo that had scoliosis and was bent sideways. Maybe it happens to deer, too. I mean, you'd think wolves would eat it, but there hasn't been a wolf around here in 100 years. 200. Anyway, I had enough on my plate without taking on the woes of damaged deer. Dreaming about the carved stones. Oof. I'd taken a photo of one, hadn't I? The phone had made the camera noise before it shut off. I turned my phone on, noted that despite more than a day on the charger, it was at 15% battery and sinking fast, and checked the photos. The last one in the roll was washed out, a gray shape on a white background, badly distorted. The lines looked less like carvings and more like a badly filtered fingerprint. I sighed and turned the phone back off. It had dropped to 9% while I was squinting at it. Bongo climbed onto the bed, grumbling in the back of his throat. Go back to sleep, nitwit. I shoved my feet beneath him. If I dreamed at all after that, I don't remember it.